Session number 31558.
John Glasley Thompson, reel 9.
And many of them had their wings knocked off trying to land between these poles. I think it's incredibly good navigation to have got in exactly like that. That was on D-Day when they did that landing. And then we went on we got to just to the east of Colombel, which is the factory area of Caen. And there were huge fires burning there. It was all burning. And actually, before the start of the thing, we'd seen this very, very heavy bombardment of Caen and of the German positions, the known for German positions. And that was very spectacular. It went on, the bombers went on and wheeled and then came back. And some of them were hit and crashed. Well, we could see them crashing. We couldn't see where they crashed. But there was one with its engine on fire, and I think his tail had been damaged as well, which I particularly remember seeing. And when we got to Colombel, we opened out, there was enough space, and it was B Squadron was leading the regiment, and the regiment was leading the division, actually. And so we opened out in an area that had been a landing strip by the Germans. And it began to get dark, so I saw from just before we got there some Canadian, I knew they were Canadian, I don't know how, I remember now, tanks were going in and attacking the Germans in Colombel, and they were fired at, and they pulled out from that, and so we stopped for the night just beyond where some Germans still were holding out. And we had two or three hours sleep, and we got very badly bitten by mosquitoes. And in the morning, I got up and I could see in front about 50 yards what looked like a machine gun covered with a tarpaulin. So I put the gunner covering us, and with the wireless operator and loader, I went forward, and we got there, and we found it was a Spandau, and we got out of the slit trench beside was two or three very frightened Germans who came up and surrendered, and got from them a very nice little Browning 7.65 Browning, which I afterwards gave. I had it for years, and then there was talk about handing in weapons that were getting in the wrong hands, so I gave it to the National Army Museum. And they still got it, I hope. Anyway, it's in perfect condition. Kept well greased and looked after.
Had you been briefed about the procedure for taking prisoners?
No. I don't think what we did was we made sure they hadn't got weapons and then to wave them to go back. Usually by the time it came to taking those prisoners, they would rather leave to beat prisoners. So I don't think that lot could have been any of the 1st SS Panzer Division, because they weren't at all like that. They didn't give up very easily. And then I brought him back, and I was going to go out for another one. I thought I'd better take them back one or two at a time, because the other dugout slit trenches in front. And anyway, I got these ones, got them back, and they were sent off to a camp, I suppose. But then we were told to advance, and we moved forward a bit. But really was the most, supposed to be the most awful traffic jam of all time. The three armored divisions trying to get on one road, to get all two roads over the bridge and then spread out. It was absolutely awful. So we went ahead then after this London Bridge. We were held up the next day again by the Guards Armored Division, and eventually we got to a bridge under the railway line. it was raised up railway. There were these bridges underneath, and that is what we'd been holding everybody up. And I remember when we went through it, it was the corpse of a RSM in the guards. He was lying on his back as though he was at attention. He looked just, his moustache propped up. It was rather pathetic in a way to see him. I hadn't actually said to you about Normandy, but the one thing that was so apparent everywhere is everything was dead that you saw. Every field had dead, had all the cows were dead, and the horses, and the, I think I mentioned the one at Jerusalem that had this horse on its back with its legs up, blown up like a toy. It was, and dead people. It was really a horrible situation. There was such a smell everywhere. Even on the road sometimes you'd run over something in the tank. You hadn't seen a bit of earth and it was a dead person. You couldn't tell whether they were English or German. But it was very, very unpleasant. But it got a bit better, of course, once we got away from the Bocage country on this joint. So we saw him. And then towards evening, we were able to advance a bit. There was a village called Ifs on our right and Hubert Folly on the left, and we were going to between them, and my troop was the leading troop, and we were at the edge of a big cornfield there, and it looked like there was a hedge at the other far side. Looked about a mile away, not more than that, but it was a big field, and there were I think it was four or five Cromwells burning on the left from the 11th Armoured Division, who put in an attack there earlier that day. And so I was very cautious then, instead of being rather foolhardy, as I'd been before Villers-Picard. And so I went up to my tank and I pulled up the other two Cromwells. Then I called up Bob Moore with the Firefly, and then I did this going short distances. And Frank Arkwright came up and said, for goodness sake, get a move on. And Tony Jarvis said, don't push John, he's doing very well, because he could see, being the squadron leader, what I was up against. And so I did this until I got to this horrible hedge where I thought something would obviously, where the anti-tank gun nested had been on a Tiger, had knocked out the Cromwells who'd attacked earlier. That's why I was so cautious, because I imagined it was possibly still there. But when I got up to the hedge, it was all right, it wasn't there. So I put the other two Cromwells, one each side of me, and Bob Moore with his Cromwell, with his Sherman, further back out of the way. And we spent, well, I saw a gun firing on the right. Well, I couldn't see the gun, but I could see where it had fired from. So we put down some HE there, and it didn't fire again. And we stayed there all night, and a platoon of infantry came up, and they were told to be in support with us. So I stayed in the hedge and said, this will be our headquarters, to the platoon leader, and you stay there. And we didn't get any sleep that night at all, actually. We just sat there, and we were sort of dozing, I was, and suddenly there was a colossal bang. And the gunner said, oh, it's 88mm. It didn't sound at all like that, but I didn't know what it was. It turned out one of their sections had thrown a hand grenade at the other by mistake in the darkness. And they'd wounded one person rather badly, so he had to be got out and evacuated. And then by two corporals' tank, three people came out and said, we'd rather have a court-martial than go on any more. So I knew that they'd been in the regiment all the way through. They'd been knocked out about 10 or 12 times, each of them. And so I was very sorry for them. I said, so would I, but we don't have the choice. We've got to, so just go on. So they said, all right, they went back and they stayed, but they were very frightened. And everybody was rather jittery. And in the morning, we were being shelled at we were moved a little bit further, we were shelled at from Ifs. And they imagined they had an OP in the church tower. So 5th RHA got onto it, and very quickly they knocked the tower down. And then the accurate shelling stopped. And we moved forward and came to a slight forward slope. In this thing, three armoured divisions were supporting the two Canadian infantry divisions, who were supposed to have gone through first. And we went along, and again I was in front doing the same trick, and then there was a road came from right to left, and down it came a number of anti-tank guns. I just saw a gap, I saw one go through, and quickly we had a AP in the gun, and we put that through the limber of this. And then the next one came, and I fired a burst machine gun because they hadn't time to reload into the limber of that, and it went down, all the ammunition exploding. And then two more came, but then Tony said, "Well, do you know what these are?" I said, "No." So he said, "Hold it, I'm not sure that they are the right thing." And actually, it was a case we were doing friendly fire. They weren't supposed to be there at all. They were Canadians, and they were 17 pounders towed by cut off rams or some tank like that. No, they had eight. They had bigger wheels. I don't know what it was towing them. Anyway, after a bit, they all came back. The Canadian who was sitting on the back of the lorry with the ammunition exploding, still smoking a cigarette there, and only the first one had run, been taken prisoner and captured, so three of them got back, or two of them got back. And then we went on a bit further, and we crossed this road, and in front was another slope up to a wood. And so I went up and held the right-hand side of the wood, and number one troop, Alan Bailey, went up to the left-hand side of the wood. And so I was on the east side, and he was on the west side. And on the way up, we went through a cornfield, and ever so many Germans were in the cornfield, and they got up and surrendered. Well, we encouraged them, because we were firing the machine gun into the cornfield and firing shells into it, just to see if anybody was there, because it could have been one of these Panzerfausts, and they would have knocked out our tank if they got close enough. So we had to get them, and when they came up with their hands up and obviously not carrying their weapons, we just waved them to go back, and they went very willingly. And we came up into this wood, and it was about lunchtime by the time we got into it, on the Verrières Ridge. And on the right-hand side of the wood I was, as I say, and Alan Bailey on the left. Well, then there was reported over the air that four German tanks were advancing towards us from the west. So I didn't know whether they would run into Alan Bailey or whether they'd skirt the wood and come up our side, and whether they were going, where, how far to the east of us they were. And so I put my tank first of all, and then I put the two other Cromwells, and then the Firefly. And I thought, if they come around the corner and I start shooting at them, they would immediately shoot at me, so that the other two Cromwells could damage their tracks, or if they're tigers or panthers, perhaps even do more damage than that. And they, anyway, attract their attention so Bob could knock them out with a Firefly, and that would have been really worthwhile. But nothing happened. The Germans knew we were there because they were firing Nebelwerfers at us all the time. You heard the sound of the rocket and then the wail on it they put on. I suppose it was supposed to frighten you. But it was more the bombs, the eight barrels exploding, which were very accurate. They came each side of the tank from one burst, and none of the tanks was actually hit, but all around we were. And so I closed the lid because I thought the chances of being hit were too great, and so the others did too, actually. And so we stood there. I could hardly keep awake. It was very warm, and I felt terribly sleepy. Whether it was because of just that, or because I hadn't had much sleep, or in stressful moments, I learned afterwards when I was zoologists that people do sometimes react by tending to go to sleep at critical moments because it's a stress effect. But at the time, I just felt sleepy. But I did stay awake, all right, because I was more frightened than sleepy. And they didn't come, and they didn't come. And then Tony said we had to be pulled out because there was going to be infantry attack, and we were in the way of their fire plan. And Ken Tout in his book says that we were the only people ever to get as far as that in the offensive of objectives of Goodwood. So we got further south than anybody on that, and when the Canadians did attack it, they had 400 casualties a few days later. So anyway, we went out, and I was still closed down, but I'd opened the lid, of course, so I could put my head out, and I was looking through the periscope, and I saw Alan Bailey's tank coming across very close, so I said, driver left, and I put my head out, and we were under fire from these tanks, because it was quite heavy stuff going between us, but we were zigzagging, going pretty fast, because that's the one thing Cromwell could do, is go fast.
What sort of speeds was it managing?
Well, we could do 30 miles an hour, which was good. Tiger could do about 12, I think, flat out. So it was a good... anyway, we got down to the bottom, over the road again, back the other side, up the, it was in a bit of a hollow, and then we stopped, and all the four flower flies from these squadrons were lined up on the hedge, and we could see it through our glasses or with the naked eye quite easily. It was less than a mile range, and they all fired. And the four German tanks were all knocked out. I don't know how many, but there were some Tigers and some Mark IV Specials, I think. But it was very, very good shooting, really, because they had to get them quick before they could come around and see if there was somebody shooting, who was shooting at them. That was one of the major successes of that part of what was called Goodwood, but we didn't know it. And then... we were still a little bit further back, and I thought, well, perhaps I'll try and shave. It seems to be quiet now. And as I just started, some Fokker Wolfs came round and started shooting at the people in the next regiment who were on our left, down in a hollow. And I saw their rockets going out. And then one turned off and aimed at me, and I thought, is it on fire? And I suddenly realized there was a couple of rockets for each thing. So I dived under the tank, and the rockets came all around it. I don't know whether they hit it or not, but they weren't very big ones. Nothing like things typhoons could fire. And then it went off, and I got out and put my shirt on and decided to give it up. And then Tony Jarvis called us over on the radio, and it began to pelt with rain. I didn't realize that there was a storm brewing at all, but there was so much shelling going on, possibly I didn't hear anything. There was a thunder that must have happened. Anyway, I ran over to him, and he was only 50 yards on my left, and I had to lie down in his sopping wet oats three times on the way, or four times when the salvos came over, so they were shelling us fairly heavily. And when he got there, he said, we're going to fall back to the west of Ifs. And so we were absolutely delighted. We fell back there as it got dark. And we were there for a couple of days. And then things were fairly quiet, except that the place was shelled all the time, and the tanks were shelled, so you could never, you know, get out and stretch your legs or anything like that. And then the next part of the thing, which was called Operation Torch, I think, afterwards, but again, I thought it was all part of the same battle. And one day, we got some fresh beef, which from the Canadians nearby, Canadian battery, they said that it had been come from a car was accidentally killed in the shelling at Colombel. But they told me later on that it actually taken about 12 men to drive, persuade the car to enter the building where the accident took place. And everybody had some fresh meat, which was rather nice as a result. And one day I had to go forward, I was told to go forward and collect some water cans from the knocked out Cromwells in front. But I did that very quickly because there was a shooting all the time, all round the place. It was absolutely constant, the firing at that time. And it wasn't really safe outside the tank. And I collected, but the reason was that most people's water tanks, which we couldn't have the space to store inside, had been holed and we were very short of water. And I did that and got back. And then we were being shelled by something really very heavy, and they thought it was from the shell fragments that it was a marine gun, a battleship gun, or something bigger than 88. And so we moved back still further. And during this time, my engine got overheated, so the tank had to go off to Colombel, where the workshops were. And I spent the night on a troop corporal's tank and sent him back with my tank. So that was not very nice for me. And the next day they came back, thank goodness, and the thing was put right. And so I got my own crew. And we dug quite a big hole, a moderately big hole, under the tank. And I think people thought it was rather odd to do that, but the chances of being caught under the hole by burning petrol, I think, were very much greater than being hit if you were on ground level. And one night, the shell landed so close that I found my blanket, which I'd sewn up into a sleeping bag, were covered in mud, which had been blown up by this shell. It was so close, about 5 yards beside me. But I didn't wake up. I dimly heard something in the night, and went back to sleep because I was so tired. And in the morning the next day, I was again trying to shave because I tried to look respectable as possible. And a shell came down very close. And I tried to get into the hole, and I got stuck because I had so many things, field dressings and emergency food and things like that, in my battle dress, and the crew inside were roaring with laughter. When it was finished, I said, "We'll make this entrance on the back a little bit larger, please, so I can get in more quickly." And everybody was so good-natured, and they were laughing, even me, the troop leader. And I couldn't help but be rather pleased about it, that we were on that sort of terms. But I suppose when you're in a bad situation, you do. Scott had the same thing, didn't he, with his people in the Antarctic. And another night there was a big air raid, was firing down the chandelier things, bombs and so on. They had chandelier flares and they fired down onto our anti-aircraft guns. Because we were all mixed up, the sort of defense and the offense. Anne's answer. And so the next night we moved forward. We were told there was going to be another offensive, and there would be two searchlights giving us the direction and light and so on. And Bob Moore came to share the hole we got beneath my tank, because he said his crew was so jittery that he couldn't stand being with them any longer. And so we sat, and we tried to go to sleep, but we weren't very sleepy, although we were terribly tired. And the dog tried to come in. Every time the Germans shelled us, this wretched dog tried to get into one of our sleeping bags. But we couldn't turn it out because we felt sorry for it, so we put up with it. And then we had to leave at 2 o'clock in the morning. We went following the light of these fireflies. And when we came when it got light, we were almost back to where we'd been before we'd pulled back from Ifs, on that ridge looking out over the over this valley. And I saw things. It does six before the
okay.
And I saw this Panther tank there. It was far beyond our range of doing any good at all. But I wired his position, and typhoons came over and rocketed it. By that time, we were really very dependent on the RAF. Our tanks had all been painted white before we started on the on the back, so that anyone from the air could see that we were British, because they were Allied tanks. And we stopped where we were, and there was a dead cow just very close to where my tank was, and that was a horrible smell as usual. And there was a litter of guns and shells and mortars and so on, and the Canadians were not far from us. We saw one Canadian skulking along beside a hedge, and a shell hit him, and he was blown right up into the air. When he fell down, he jumped onto his feet and ran very quickly to a first aid station on the thing. And we weren't actually in the tank then, because there were obviously no Germans near us, and the smell of that cow was dreadful, and I thought we'll have to get set fire to it or something. And so we got out, and I think we left the tank for a moment. I can't remember what it was for, something rather special actually. And we were being stonked by the German artillery, so we decided to get back into the tank. It was only a few yards from us, and I said one by one, said only one person get hit. The driver did an incredible jump, put his hand on one side of the tank and landed in his driving compartment. I don't know how he managed to do that. And by the time I got in, we were all in fits of laughter at this. And then we stayed there, and then we were pulled back again a little bit, and I saw the Tiger tank in front. I knew it was one, but I didn't know whether there were any more. So again, it was a question of reporting this. And that was the time I said to the driver, "Driver, advance, they're firing at us." And Tony Jarvis said, "Get on IC." And they didn't hit any of the Cromwells, but they knocked the driving sprocket off the 17-pounder. So Bob was out of action for a bit, but it was patched up later. And three of his crew came back. I think they were probably the ones who were frightened. And they were replaced from another squadron, I think, or perhaps from depleted A squadron, because I never saw them again. The MO said they're not fit. They've all bailed out too many times. Only in the Great War, they called it shell shock. We called it bomb happy, which was perhaps less accurate. I think it was just that people reach, they have a certain amount and they can't take more. And those had it.
What was the attitude among those who were still left to those who were then drafted out?
Well, I don't think they really thought about that. They were just thinking about themselves and their own crew. They were different crews. So that anyway, I was very glad when Bob did come back with the tank operating the next day. Only one day, I think, he was off. And he'd got some more crew and got the... I was the idler wheel that was damaged, not the driving sprocket. And